Begin.
Please note that the following program includes adult themes and language. You're listening to the weekly show on Discourse.
I'm back.
Oh yeah, we're all back. I'm Morgan Nickel, big mouth dickhead from the internet.
And I'm Dylan Reeve, prepared and professional.
I'm prepared with one beer. I haven't had any
actually,
yet,
I'm
though.
I'm not prepared at all professional.
Have you got some apple juice yet?
No, I have Coke Zero today.
All right, well, Coke Zero, I suppose.
I think I saw a tropical juice somewhere as well, but it's not the same.
No, it's got too much sugar in it. You can't have that stuff. Although I did see one of those terrible, you know, those kind of Tetra Pak juice box things that was sweetened with stevia, which I imagine probably means it's a lot healthier than a lot of those juices have been.
I will look out for it, but I'll probably forget that you mentioned it.
Yeah, that's probably the best thing. So judging from last week, you don't give your children juice, only water. Is that right?
Mostly.
And only, is it just bread for dinner?
Yeah, I mean, not white bread either.
Do you beat them quite a lot?
But also not the good mixed grain either, just that wholemeal. You know, like the dollar a loaf wholemeal store brand.
I'm surprised you go wholemeal and not fully refined white.
Well, not wholemeal, you know, brown, you know, brown bread.
Allegedly whole. Yeah. Anyway, so last week we had quite a good show lately. Oh, there's fireworks going off right outside the studio window. I don't know what that's going to mean.
I can't hear it.
So or that was lightning. I mean, I suppose that's possible.
Gunshots, central Auckland.
Man, that would be serious muzzle flash if I could see that from up here then. That would be quite scary. What was I starting to say? Oh, yeah, so last week was quite a popular show. There was a bit more traction than we normally get when it's just us talking crap or me playing the quiet game while you talk crap with your friends. And that was because we spoke about something that was actually topical, which is not really our policy on Discourse, is it? Topical?
Well, it was topical and it was an area of interest / expertise in a way, with the technical geeky aspects of it.
Yeah.
And also something we've covered many times before, the whole copyright rights piracy.
And stuff involving that terrible dickhead Kim.com.
I don't think we used that phrase last week.
Let me get something out of the way.
Corrections.
Last week, Dylan suggested that we had a policy against Germans. The Discourse Weekly Show has no formal policy in favour of or against Germans.
It's very informal, and it's less of a policy, more of a framework.
And I was very surprised you said it. It was the closest I've ever heard you come to racism, I think.
Ah, I shall try harder.
Not that they don't deserve it, though.
Not after all that happened.
So we were talking about Mega, and the reason we were talking about Mega was pretty much whale oil. But as neither of us really wants to talk to Cameron Slater, and we've already spoken to, you know, one side of the kerfuffle, this week we're talking to the
other side of the kerfuffle?
The other side of the kerfuffle. We're talking to Dr. Sam Elworthy, who is the president of the Publishers Association of New Zealand and the director of Auckland University Press. And he issued the press release about luminaries being made available on Mega. Are you there, Sam?
I am here. Nice to see you or hear you, Morgan.
And so,
well, white German, so you got to watch out, all right?
Some of my dearest friends are partly German. Also,
Ich bin ein Wurst.
You are a sausage.
Yeah.
See, I'm pro at language. I'm the best. Yeah. I'm the best you've ever met.
That was my pickup line for German backpackers.
Okay, but male ones?
Mainly,
yes. And would you say it was a successful line?
Let's move on.
Okay, that's probably for the best. So, Sam, how did you first hear that Luminaries was on Mega? And do you still think that Mega is the as a South Seas pirate and so on?
Yes and yes. So I first heard about Mega or Luminaries on Mega because on Twitter actually, because I follow whale oil for all my sins. Very seldom follow
good
a link,
grief.
But on that one I did because it looked interesting. And then we talked amongst the publishers about what we'd do about it. And now the second question was, oh yeah, are they the pirates of the South Seas? Yes, I'm afraid they. I believe Mega are a rooted in piracy. I'm afraid, and yes.
I think that
grab you on the piracy thing because
I'm actually going to agree about that, but it's complicated because now obviously Kim.com made his money off essentially off piracy because Mega Upload was definitely a piracy funded site. I don't think there's a reasonable argument about that. Now, maybe you can argue whether he is an international gangster and should be extradited because of it, and that's more complicated. Mm-hmm. But Mega, they have no motivation for doing the same thing that Mega Upload did because there's no advertising.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say that the Mega site is about piracy. Obviously, some of the people behind it have been about piracy, but mm-hmm. there is some distinction that I think needs to be drawn.
Yeah, maybe, but I think it was interesting for me, like in the discussions after the Luminaries thing, is that you know, some people's argument was, hey, look, it's also on Pirate Bay and also on this and that, you know, which was equating Mega to Pirate Bay and others, you know, and some people said, so why do we pick on Mega if it's on those other places? And for me, that's an easy one to answer, which is that hey, Mega's based about 20 kilometers from where I live, and in New Zealand. And if it's a pirate site, you know, we locals who think piracy is pretty bad for authors and artists and others should jump up and down on them more than we jump up and down on the Swedes or whoever else is running a pirate site. But but the second version of the argument around Mega is, no, Mega isn't set up as a pirate site. It's set up as an alternative to Dropbox and to SkyDrive or Google Drive and so on. And I think there's plenty of evidence out there that that in fact it's a very different entity from any of those ones, and we don't have a piracy problem with Dropbox or anything. And there's good reasons why not, you know, or YouTube anymore, actually, you know, because those guys.
Well, no, YouTube still a huge piracy problem.
It's got a huge
not books.
No, it's terrible for pirated books.
Did you just kill the flow of conversation, Dylan? Is that what you just did?
Allegedly.
Without prejudice, you just killed the flow of conversation, Dylan. So now one thing that you've suggested is that because Mega don't have download limits, that is one thing that they should do that Dropbox and so on apparently do. I didn't actually know that Dropbox did that, but is that actually true?
It is true, but and I'd say on all of this, I'd back up a couple of steps is say, first, you know, I'm a book publisher. I'm not a technology guy at all. And the only reason I'd wade in is because some technology guys are a bit shy of doing so. Though there are, you know, like Nat Talkington, he's been out. He was out there at the start of the launch of Mega, very clear that hey, this was a way of redoing Mega Upload in a way that was more resistant to takedown notices. You know,
and has it turned out to be that? Like, I mean, I know
was
a lot
that
of people.
A question or a...
Well, I mean, I know a lot of people were making that accusation, you know, before Mega came out or when Mega was just coming out. But I don't think, I mean, it certainly has pirated content on it. There's no doubt about that. But I certainly don't think it is anything like Mega Upload was. I don't think it's the same business model.
I think that's good. But how would you compare it with Dropbox?
Well, I mean, from my usage of it, it's basically the same. I'm not hunting pirated content on it, but if I see links to pirated content, then seldom to Mega, and then much more often to places like RapidShare or PutLocker or there's a whole bunch of them. I can't remember them all, but you know, Mega doesn't show up there in nearly the same way that Mega Upload used to. Mega Upload was, you know, for that type of piracy, it was the place.
Hey, but you know, my question was, you know, how it compares with Dropbox, because that's the claim. You know, you got to think that's the legitimacy claim. You know,
well, there certainly are pirated files on Dropbox. I have definitely seen pirate links to Dropbox. I don't know what Dropbox does differently to Mega that would make it less appealing as a target location. But I also don't think
it does do quite a few things differently. You know.
But I mean, I also don't think Mega is inherently it isn't. There's nothing about Mega that seems to be attracting pirates, and there's nothing in Mega's business model that would seem to benefit from piracy. And both of those things are different to how Mega Upload was. I mean, I also don't think Kim.com inherently is a pirate. I think he's an opportunist capitalist, really.
Yeah.
He saw opportunities to make money in ways that he understood and took them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think he has any interest in particularly, you know, he's not, I don't think he's some sort of, you know, anarchist pirate or something who thinks that all content should be free. I think he just wants to make money.
Well, but he has. I mean, he started as a hacker and a pirate at a young age, you know, and breaking down, you know, which is what a lot of young and interesting people did. So I wouldn't take that away from him. I think he'd quite be proud of, you know, like what he did in Germany, you know, as when he started his career, you know.
Certainly. I don't think he has any particular ideological bent towards stealing content, and you know, however that means. I think now he's a businessman who wants to make money, and he saw opportunities to make money in a way that was quasi legal. And
what are we talking about now? Mega Upload?
Well, Mega Upload originally. I mean, that's where he made most of his money, and undoubtedly, it was generating a lot of profit from piracy.
Mm-hmm.
I think they believed with Mega Upload that they were complying with enough laws that they were safe, as many of those piracy sites seem to think they are, and that is clearly something that's in dispute. But at the same time, I don't think he had any particular strong reason to do it aside from the fact it made money. I mean, it's the same reason people run porn sites. I don't think many people who run porn sites have a massive desire to spread the world of porn. They just want to make money.
Yeah.
It's just another way of making money on the internet.
I don't know. You know. I mean, I'm the wrong guy to talk about either Kim's mental motivations, you know, and what he does, or even on the technical routes, you know, that sites use, you know, to share files or to throw files on the internet and not have them pirated. But the fact is, you know, and I'd go back to it again, and I'd challenge you techie guys to go, hey, take a look at Dropbox, take a look at SkyDrive, take a look at the ones that Mega wants to compare itself to. And it wants to say, hey, we're not Mega Upload. We're not like Pirate Bay. We've got a legitimate business model here, and we're just like Dropbox and stuff. If you guys actually took a proper look at those, and it doesn't take much Googling around, and I can tell you the answers from my non-technical background, but this is a book publisher speaking, I'm useless at it. You know, you guys could do it far better. You can look in there. It's pretty simple to find out why people are not massively using Dropbox or SkyDrive or Google Drive for pirating stuff, and why Mega is actually quite a good one for them to do it on.
Is it a good one for them to do it on? Because it's
quite decent, actually. My son tells me about why it's quite good, because it's better than the torrent. It has some advantages over the torrent sites because you're not relying on someone else's upload as you're downloading to get the thing. You know, so if it's actually sitting out there on some servers, and you can
fair
get
enough
very quickly.
Also, the New Zealand Three Strikes copyright regime really can't possibly apply to Mega because it relies on seeing the IP address of the person that's sharing a file, and i.e. it's something that only really works over torrents. And I mean, once upon a time there were things like, what was it called, Hotline and stuff, but those don't really exist anymore. Or maybe
CC.
Direct Client Connect stuff with IRC. I suppose that would still theoretically be a thing, but torrents are the obvious choice. So in that sense, something like Mega would be preferable. But having spoken to Vikram...
No, it's interesting. What do you make of Vikram? Their remarkable ability when they want to identify the IP addresses and the email addresses of the upload.
Well, I mean, of course,
and the
they
downloads
have...
And, we'd love them to share that information, of course.
Well, they can't. I mean, well, like, I suppose they could, but...
They could. He just showed they could.
Well, I'm not sure they would legally, though.
He could share the number of downloads of illegal content they've had. That was
clear. Well, they can't know what content is illegal. I mean, that's the other thing.
So there's about 270,000 takedown notices they've had. It was clear that he does know how many... If he looks at an item, he can see how many times...
Oh, yeah, of course.
So that'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I suppose it would. And it would also be interesting to know, you know, on those cases. There's lots of stuff that would be fascinating to know. And I mean, you know, they're hosting millions and millions of files. It's clear that not all of them. In fact, you know, I've got 45,000 files on Dropbox.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, I'm not on Dropbox, on Mega.
Mm-hmm.
And
Christ,
precisely
really?
Zero of those are infringing copyright.
Mm-hmm. Hey, but guys, you don't have to answer my questions because I'm in the interviewee stand. But don't you think the technology community should be challenging a little bit their claim that they're like Dropbox and do a little bit of looking and go, hey, how come if I search, you know, freely child ebook downloads, Dropbox never, never, never appears?
Well, that is interesting.
Mega
I would like to know.
And there are some clear reasons for that. I could tell you them, but it's tough to ask.
I suspect
don't ask yourself.
Yeah, well, one of those reasons will be that it's that your material isn't encrypted when it's on Dropbox. You could possibly make the claim that, you know, the only reason that Mega have done that is for deniability purposes. Yep. But it is a clear distinction and, in fact, in some ways an advantage, especially, you know, when you consider the Snowden leaks and the whole NSA, GCHQ spying debacle, which is ongoing. For things to be encrypted end-to-end, that is clearly an advantage. And there are legitimate reasons for people to want to believe that they have privacy. And that is being able to look at the files in any user's Dropbox automatically is an advantage for being able to screen out and filter out potentially infringing content. So that is one reason, and I suspect it's one of the ones that you would have mentioned.
Yeah, I would have. The search function is key, though, too, because Dylan asked on Twitter, hey, what a dumb pirate site, doesn't have a search box. But of course, it does have a search box. So,
well, it doesn't.
No, it hasn't. There's no browse function.
No. But external sites offer good indexing and searching.
Well, I mean, they don't. Like, the biggest one I've seen indexes 370,000 files. And of those, like, I clicked on about 10 or 15 of them randomly. And of those, probably more than 70% were offline now.
I don't want this to turn into a kind of a he said, she said thing where we end up defending a company that we actually have nothing to do with. I have a Mega account and I've uploaded exactly zero files into it because I happen to be deeply in love with Dropbox because it has such wonderful integration with all of my devices. So, I mean, I have no reason to use Mega.
And same thing. I mean, I use Dropbox as well and I use them for slightly different purposes, but... it's interesting to me because to me it seems the focus on Mega is and unavoidably so because of who created it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also to some extent because of the name, you know, it's chosen to continue that the name association with the original one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean I can't see, like, if I were to upload, I don't know, a bunch of episodes of television to Mega and share the links on one of those indexing sites and people would download them.
Mm-hmm.
I benefit in no way. Mega benefits in no way. In fact, it costs them money.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't see a reason to believe that Mega has an interest in either condoning implicitly or explicitly or promoting piracy. I think they're an unavoidable target from both sides. The pirates obviously go there because it's got the name association and because, frankly, it's a pretty good service for free.
Yep.
And it's fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to use. And the focus is put on it for the reason that it's got the name association and Kim.com's involved. And I think it's probably both sides are kind of attacking Mega sort of unfairly. But you raise a good point. I'm curious to know why it doesn't seem to happen with Dropbox and SkyDrive. I mean, I know it does, but to a lesser extent or to a less, maybe a less visible extent.
Because I think that's the you know, if you try and have a try, I could not find any way to search inside, you know, in Dropbox there are clearly plenty of files that are publicly available, you know, that the users have made publicly available. I couldn't find a way to search that. In Mega you can. In Dropbox, if you throw up a movie and it gets downloaded not very many times at all, then it'll exceed the limitations, you know, that it allows there, you know. And then a lot of the sites like YouTube and stuff that said, hey, we've got a shitload of pirated content on our site. We better actually talk to the people who own that content, like the movie industry and the music industry and the book industry, you know, and find ways of working with them, you know, and doing blanket licenses and stuff like that. Encryption.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the YouTube model is interesting,
mm-hmm.
and even then they're still getting sued constantly.
Yeah.
But it also, I mean, it raises a bunch of issues. Like I've had three videos, and in fact, luckily it hasn't happened yet. But I've had three videos on YouTube hit with copyright infringement.
Mm-hmm.
One of them legitimately, I was using a piece of commercial music I wasn't entitled to. Mm-hmm. Two of them without any legitimacy. And in theory, if you get three copyright strikes on YouTube, they delete your account and everything in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not disable, delete.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their system is pretty imperfect and also rife with abuse from the other angle, where businesses are, you know, utilizing copyright as a way of stifling permitted legal speech.
Maybe, or maybe just, you know, I sort of, you know, I hear that.
Yeah, I mean, it's
you've got to hear the other side too. Like, if you're a publisher of any scale, you know, like the idea of, you think on Mega, of knocking out the first time that file appears on one of those mega search engines, you know, because you managed to crawl it and see that it's there. And there are probably, you know, there can be tens and hundreds of other of those files within Mega that won't be deleted even at that stage. And then someone makes the open link to that one. So that while the for the user, you know, putting up content, you know, having copyright owners come and knock it down, sometimes not for the right reason, is frustrating. You know, the other version is frustrating too, as a, you know, as a publisher who, you know, pays authors, invests money in them, publishes books, to have to do the same sort of knock them down in these large numbers of websites, so, some of which like Mega are encrypted, is a ridiculous game too.
So, but here's a question though: is it a fight worth having then? I mean, because no matter how proactive you get, and no matter how much effort you put into finding and issuing takedown notices. Yep. You know, you'll never catch it all, but anyone who legitimately wants to go out and find something is going to find it. Like, you know, as long as it exists somewhere, it's going to be going to be able to be found. So is it, like, who are you stopping by taking them down? Is it because there's some arguments to be made in research that's been done that suggests that piracy can actually be a net benefit to creative artists in various ways.
For some authors, that clearly has been a huge benefit, but I don't know that would be true of the real money makers. Like, I doubt Stephen King gets much benefit, or any other, you know, big names, because they are already successful publishers.
Sure.
I think the advantage is
probably a lot. I mean, that's, you know.
Well, it depends on what you count as a loss. Is every download, is that a lost sale, or is that someone? Now, I mean, this is not a legal argument that I'm making, but not every download is a lost sale, because there's a reasonable chance that a person that downloaded it wasn't going to buy it. But there's also, now I am going to front up now, I have downloaded illegally books before. I got a bunch of what the hell is his bloody name, the guy that just died, Ian M. Banks. I got some Ian M. Banks books several years ago, and I've since purchased every Ian M. Banks book in actual paper form, because I was exposed to those illegal copies, including the ones that I downloaded. And if anyone doubts the veracity of that, I can take a photo with my camera and tweet it if you want to see my my bookcase. So, I mean, there are cases where a download will absolutely lead to book sales. I am certainly an example of that. But there are also, of course, the counter. I think someone like Stephen King, I don't see any advantage to him of illegal downloads.
I'd say a few things on that. One is, you know, come and, you know, have a cup of coffee at Auckland University Press, sit you down with 10 authors, and I'll sit you down with 100 authors, and try and find one who's excited about giving their work away and doesn't negotiate their contracts with me, you know, quite tightly, and you'll be amazed. And it frustrates me, honestly, when, you know, there's the great organization called something like the Creative Freedom Foundation, and there's some new organization in Australia that call themselves the Creationistas. And what's great about, you know, who are all for, you know, giving stuff away and open access and all that sort of stuff. And I'm like, every time I see those organizations, I'm like, sit down with 10, 100, give you 1,000 authors, and find one actual creative person who's actually doing creative work and publishing it and finding readers and doing all that stuff, and find one who believes in that they should give it away and it'll be great for their career. It'll be
Cory Doctorow.
Great. You know, it'll be a, yeah, you know, no, you will find one in 1,000, but, you know, talk to Elizabeth Knox about that sort of stuff, you know, or any of my authors, honestly. And it's a funny belief, especially, you know, and, you know, and we publishers, we spend a lot of time with authors, so we know them a little bit.
But I mean, there's a pragmatic reality to it.
Just to finish that, Dylan, the flip side of that is piracy in books. We don't have a problem at all. You know, what's great is that the book industry, you know, and our little industry, even in New Zealand, have been very active about turning our books into ebooks quickly, and about getting into Amazon and Apple, you know, and about actually having some of the great technology companies jump into our business, you know, and do great things for us, and make little devices, some of them crappy, some of them great, but make it pretty easy for people to buy for $10 pretty much any book in the universe and pop it on pretty much any device. And for that reason, we don't have a big book piracy problem. But that doesn't mean that, you know, and so part of the solution to piracy, a lot of the solution is in our hands and is doing all that stuff right. But we think we've done pretty decent on that. At the point where you think you've done pretty decent on availability, pricing, all those sorts of things, then we do think there's no excuse for piracy. You know, and a lot of, you know, people like the Electronic Freedom Foundation and stuff, they'll give you a lot of excuses for piracy that are around that, around availability or pricing and da-da-da. But, you know, for book publishers, we feel like we've done most of that stuff right. So then when piracy does appear, we do have to make it difficult for people to do. And people, you know, pirates are generally young men before they reach a high income level, you know, and everybody will say that it's a trade-off between time and hassle and money, you know, and at a certain stage, people are like, $10 or the hassle of going to some site through a few porn ads and things like that and picking up some file that sometimes, as you said, I think, Morgan, not even there because it's been taken down already. You know, it's a pain in the ass time-wise to get a pirated book. And it's and if you make it both simple enough to buy the thing and pain in the ass enough to pirate the thing, then we're on a winning streak, you know, and we are generally. But that don't, you know, that still means, you know, when one of you said, you know, hey, why bother with all this stuff, you know, if it's not really impacting business? And why bother is that there are countries that haven't bothered to, both in Spain as an example, they didn't bother, they haven't effectively created an ebook legitimate market, they haven't got their books out there, most of the bestseller list isn't available as ebooks, and they haven't combated pirate sites enough. There, it's a bloody disaster. Piracy huge, ebook sales tiny, and it'll be fairly unrecoverable actually in that country, I think, you know, to get to a decent sort of situation. So we think we are in a pretty decent situation, but it does mean that when we see sort of flagrant violations out there, we let people know about it and try and bring them down.
Now, some people, this is a little bit of a right turn, a U-turn perhaps, orthogonal point perhaps. Why are ebook prices so high and sometimes the same or sometimes more than a paperback of the same book?
Mm-hmm. You should look around, I think. You know, it depends, you know, you know, there's competing ebook providers, ebook retailers out there. In New Zealand, Amazon is dominant, as it is in most other countries. And there are other providers here, Apple and Kobo and all sorts of others. And pricing differs a lot by retailer, a hell of a lot. And so you've got to shop around a bit. And then there are some publishers, I think most publishers now, who think that, hey, you've got to have pretty much world pricing. You know, so all our books, all from University Press, almost all of them were available $9.99 New Zealand, which I think is about the right price for an ebook. And but there are some publishers who price higher. I think the market will tell them that ain't going to work, honestly.
Something else, another indication I'd like the market to give. I can take any book, and I actually prefer, even though I'm in technology and we have Kindles and we have tablets and so on, I prefer paper. Mm-hmm. I'm just old enough to, you know, like the smell and the feel and so on. I can take any one of my books and I can lend it to Dylan, and he can lend it to a friend and they can return it to me. And I can't do that with ebooks. That seems like something that is a pretty big downside. And that kind of sharing, I think legitimate sharing. Is a great way to learn about new authors.
So a couple of things on that. I mean, it's interesting that in the US, which is a fully mature ebook market, and ebook sales are basically topped out, you know, about 25% of the market. It's interesting there that ebook buyers buy as many print books as non-ebook owners.
Right.
You know, and they buy. So ebook reader, you know, people who own an ebook reader over there buy about half their books in print and half their books in e. So so that you ain't alone in continuing to read.
People who buy books is the people who buy ebooks buy lots of books, and people who don't buy ebooks buy fewer books.
Yes, no, that's true. That's though there's something about the
30 minutes
total number that isn't quite clear on that. But I think what the Americans came to is that people who bought e-readers at first in North America just stopped buying print books completely. They were like, cool, I got this great device. You know, books are half the price or less than what they were in physical. I ain't buying a physical book in my life. And then it took them about a year or two, and then they came back and bought physical books. And now, I think people sort of realize, hey, there's good uses for physical books at times and places. And they have some advantages like lending, and there's good uses for e-books as well. You know, on the lending thing, I think, you know, like Amazon offers – I don't know, but I wouldn't be good on the specifics. But Amazon does offer some sort of limited lending capacity. Yeah. And I think most publishers would be, you know, and it takes the retailers to come up with decent business models for it. But most publishers are pretty comfortable with some sort of limited lending capacity that you can do with an ebook, you know, and as they are with print books. You know, we sell print books, and I sell my ebooks all to libraries as well. And we sell print books to libraries and, you know, to individuals, and there's plenty of lending. But there is a price differential between ebooks and print books for a reason. You know, ebooks don't have all the advantages of print. You know, they ain't gonna, you know, despite what techies might tell you, you know, I reckon the ebook file, you know, the chances of it being round and lovely in 10, 15 years are, I would rate them fairly low, whereas I rate the chances of my books on
e-everything.
Well, it is e-everything.
I mean, I have this whole ongoing fear of the fact that we're going to have nothing left to show for our lives in 10 years from now.
Oh, I agree.
It's one of the risks of having a kind of a licensed, sort of a leased or rented file instead of a physical artifact, is that it can just go away. Now, I mean, a book can burn up in a fire, but, yeah, you know, there have been cases where Amazon have, you know, reached out into people's Kindles, mm-hmm, metaphorically speaking, and deleted books.
Well, no, it's true.
Which is kind of, it's kind of terrifying. You know, it's Fahrenheit, what was it, Fahrenheit
451.
451. It feels a bit book burny, doesn't it?
BitTorrent. It's a pretty good book.
I mean, it's not quite burning a book, which I think probably makes many people recoil in horror. Maybe not a publisher, though, because I expect you probably had too many books around from time to time that maybe you want.
But the threat to your ebook file, I think, is going to be less, you know, some demon multinational company pulling it off you for some terrible reason. You know, I think the larger problem is it's going to be the, VHS video of 1970, whatever. You know what I mean? It's going to be the VHS video 25 years down the line where nobody has the right equipment to open this baby.
I think a bigger issue, I mean, it's a file. You can always find a way to open a file. Someone could reverse engineer it. But the bigger issue is actually holding that file for that long. You know, hard drives die, computers get thrown out, files disappear.
We have a huge one, Dylan, that, computer typesetting, you know, it's been going since, I'm not even going to put a date on it because I'll get the date wrong, but basically, you know, it's been going maybe 20 years, a little bit more than that, and started with different programs and stuff like that, you know, and we have, at the press, enormous problems, you know, one in simply containing, you know, we need a few megas to contain the number of gigabytes that we have going in illustrated book files and stuff. When you have about 25 years of book publishing, all in files that you want to keep in multiple formats. And but the second one we do have is the VHS problem, is that things like even whatever preceded InDesign and stuff, Quark, you know, those Express files, Quark, exactly, things like that, they become, as every year goes by, the ability to open those and use those in a way that doesn't just require a whole lot of work and you feel like, might as well start from scratch again, it becomes very challenging.
That's certainly true.
So another issue I thought of. Just a second, Dylan, please, one moment. No. I've just looked it up on Amazon. The paperback for the Luminaries is $14.28. Mm-hmm. The Kindle edition is $14.99.
The paperback of the Luminaries, how are you signed in on Amazon?
I just have a normal account. This will be a US price, I think.
See, I would. You keep talking.
All right.
Yeah, because I looked at it, I don't think it was that much. But I see.
Yeah, in the US, go on. Yep.
I see $9.99 for a Kindle and $16.20 for a hardcover.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. See, I see that.
That's so weird. Why am I getting a higher price? Have they decided that
I'm wealthy? $9.99 for the Kindle and $14.28 for the paperback.
Right, so we've got the same paperback price, but I've got a higher Kindle edition price.
Wow, sucks to be you. I'm not. Am I logged in?
What the hell?
I am logged in.
Why are they screwing me around?
It depends where it thinks you are. And then so Amazon's a funny old beast, because then sometimes that $16.20 I would believe is actually a US dollar price. And then when you get to your checkout.
Oh, no, it's definitely a US dollar price.
It'll turn it into whatever, you know, $20 or something like that. But you look at that, you know, what's great about the American book market and the New Zealand book, I shouldn't say, I get a, you know, get killed at dawn for it, but that the hardcover is priced at $27, its retail price, and in the US you can routinely buy, you know, Amazon's taking a loss on that. So it's $16.20, you know, Amazon won't be getting as much discount from the bookseller as that, but you know, it's a hot book that they're selling a lot of, and they've lost money every year they've existed Amazon, so they'll take a loss on it, which they will be doing on the Kindle edition too, actually. And so the consumer in the US, you know, is getting a hell of a bargain there. You'd struggle to pay the print costs on that hardcover for not quite, but you know the direct costs involved in that hardcover are very high. You know,
it's one of the reasons I want to live in the States. Everything's so stupidly cheap.
It is stupidly cheap.
Give me book depository every time. Now, and
book depository is interesting, though. You noticed recently that prices, you know, the book depository's huge loss leading prices have disappeared.
Yeah.
Well, they got bought by Amazon, didn't they?
They did get bought by Amazon, but it's not clear that they kept it going for quite a while. It's not quite clear why they disappeared.
So I got a thing. I mean, the book industry has quite a lot of advantages going for it. One of them is that it's, you know, you're later to the digital realm than than some of the other creative industries.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a lot to follow on from, I guess. And it's interesting to see. I mean, like you say, the piracy is not a big issue because, frankly, electronic books aren't a particularly established thing yet. I mean, obviously much more so. But you've come to
be established. I wouldn't say that.
Well, I mean, much more so now. But I mean, we've been dealing with, you know, MP3s since the early 90s.
Yeah.
And it's interesting watching how those markets have progressed.
Mm.
Film and TV.
I think you just lied, Dylan. What's this early 90s rubbish? The first time I ever encountered an MP3, I think, was about 1997.
Okay, maybe 96. Yeah, 97.
False memory. Okay.
Mid 90s.
I'm looking this up.
Okay, good. You can come back to me.
Yeah.
It's MP2 Layer 3 audio if you're having trouble. But the
initial release 1995. There you go.
Okay. Film and TV has their own problems, but music's quite well developed, and to the point where music was dealing with a piracy epidemic at one stage.
Yeah.
And has flipped that around almost completely to where online sales through the likes of iTunes are, I think they actually constitute more than 50% of the revenues in the music industry now.
I think that's quite true, in part because the licensed revenue has increased as well. You know, licenses through, you know, Spotify and things like that, but a lot of other formats too.
Although Spotify, which is still terribly low licensing fees, But I mean, where they've gone is they've actually mostly walked away from DRM. I think everything on iTunes now is DRM free, because it became clear that the benefit to consumers from DRM, well, there wasn't really a benefit to consumers, but the annoyance to consumers from DRM was greater than the benefit to publishers. Do you think that'll happen with digital books?
I don't know. It's pretty, you know, it's unclear, and I'm pretty agnostic on it, honestly, but I think it's unclear. You know, there's, you know, books have some advantages in the digital world. So it turns out, like, you know, one thing is, you know, with records is that people both want the singles, you know, the individual bites, and they want the whole meal. And with books, it turns out, despite publishers trying to sell shorts and serials and all sorts of different ways of breaking up a book, there's zero customer interest out there. You know,
so just want the book.
They want the book. They want a long form piece. That's what they're paying for, you know. And so in that way, I think, you know, we have a bit of an advantage over the music industry that it's something quite substantial and something that's going to suck quite a lot of time and that you want, you know. So there's a bit more reason to pay, you know, whereas, you know, so that when people talk about Spotify for books and stuff, well, it doesn't quite work like that, you know, because Spotify kind of breaks up all the little pieces and gives you little, you know, snippets of this and snippets of that, and books don't work. So we have some advantages.
A reason that it couldn't? I mean, look at the sites like Oyster and the other ones, Scribd.
Favorite site, Oyster. I think there's a, you know, on that, which I think is a bit of a diversion, honestly. And I always think, you know, it's always great when the people from, well, I don't know, it'd be like me telling him how to run Mega, which I probably was doing earlier, but I'd be a fool doing that. And I think he may be not the wisest man to tell, you know, to tell book retailers and publishers how to run their business. But there are some good arguments there just when you look at book buying patterns that, yeah, in fact, not enough consumers buy enough books to make a subscription sort of model look attractive to them, you know, whereas Netflix in the US is very attractive because Americans in particular can watch shitloads of movies every night, you know, and
Netflix is great. I highly recommend it.
Say again?
Netflix is great. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, it is too.
I have to jump through a few hoops to make it work here, but, you know, it's worth it.
No, it's, so, you know, and hey, but I was going to say, but books, you know, one of our disadvantages, which is not really a disadvantage, but it's a bit of a pain in the neck, is on the DRM front, is that ebook files are, for the most part, tiny. You know that, you know.
Yeah, a couple of megs.
A megabyte or sometimes 4 megabytes, 5 megabytes if it's Illustrator or something. But, you know, these are tiny files. So whereas a non-DRM'd music stuff is a bit of a pain in the ass to get around. Non-DRM'd book stuff is, I could, you know, email you 50 books. Oh, no, not quite. Kind of 50, you know what I mean? I could email you a lot of EPUB and Mobi files.
Can you just send me a Dropbox link?
Yeah, exactly. And so that makes it a little bit trickier. But certainly there's a lot of publishers out there, you know, doing, you know, Riley's done it for a long time, but there's a lot of other publishers out there doing non-DRM, you know, and I think a lot of other publishers watching and seeing how it works because one of the, you know, we face an environment where Amazon is very dominant and relies on a proprietary format, you know, with Mobi that it uses on the Kindle, you know, sort of closed ecosystem where you can only buy through that. And that is helped by a DRM environment, their dominance.
See, I love the Kindle as a device for reading, yeah, on it. It's very good. But the whole closed source Mobi thing annoys me because I don't like the idea that I'm buying books that then if my Kindle breaks or I find a device I like better, that I can't read those books. They're not really mine.
Yeah.
But the Oyster thing, you say, you know, we look at book buying patterns and how people buy books, mm-hmm, as an example for why Oyster might not be useful.
Or more reading, how many books they read a year. You know, they need,
but then wouldn't libraries be a better example for what Oyster could be? Because I mean, there are, mm-hmm, certainly publishers and authors who have argued against libraries, and mm-hmm, in fact, there's one moderately prominent New Zealand blogger, I think, mm-hmm, had a big blog against libraries a while ago that got him a little bit of negative attention.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of Oyster as a library, but a library that can actually pay royalties to authors based on who reads what, mm-hmm, then isn't that yeah, that seems like a good thing, because I think half the reason I don't buy books is because I do buy books occasionally, but half the reason I don't buy books much is because I only read a book once usually, mm-hmm, and it seems like, I mean, not that it really is, but it seems like an expensive proposition for a one-off thing.
Two cups of coffee, man. But
very expensive cups of coffee.
What?
Very expensive cups of coffee.
No, $9.99. That's two cups of coffee.
I mean, it might be an expensive cup of coffee, but that could represent years of that author's work. Yeah. I don't necessarily have a problem
No, of course, but I don't expect to pay. You know, I'm not paying the author myself, and I think
maybe you should,
like the Netflix model. I'm happy to pay an author myself if we can find one that'll write exactly what I want. But I think the Netflix model is beneficial because you look at what Netflix has been able to achieve simply by getting enough content that enough people are interested in that it can...
Totally.
I can't see why that shouldn't work for something like Oyster, but then the problem...
I think we'd...
The problem we see with Oyster...
From the publisher's perspective, Dylan, is just that we got no problems with it at all. You know, like,
yeah,
they can find, you know, yeah, it'd be cool, you know, and
he's got to find the right licensing model.
Yeah, exactly, and but you know, and they've got to find enough content, you know, and persuade publishers, you know, they've got the right licensing model. And if they have enough content, then they've got to find enough customers. I'm just a little, I'm more skeptical than you that that model is going to have a lot of traction, honestly.
It just seems, it seems to me once we get used to doing it for things like television and music, you know, with Spotify is the one where you subscribe for a music thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes. You know, we used to get used to doing it for movies and music, then it seems
minutes.
To me the books following along the same pattern make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and you know, I don't mind subscribing. Like, I pay whatever it is, $8 a month to Netflix and $6 a month to Hulu, and and I'm happy to watch whatever they offer me, really. And I'm sure they get their money's worth out of me, and I get my money's worth out of them. But then the problem that the book thing faces, I was looking at them today, is they've got the same geographic kind of limitations that that the TV and film industry impose, and to some extent the music industry, but not nearly as much. Do you think that's going to change? You pointed me at an article you wrote about this.
What'd you make of that?
Well, it's interesting, and it makes a good point that obviously, you know, someone in a particular territory with a financial incentive in selling a certain book has a much better chance of marketing that book effectively was the nuts and bolts of it, I suppose.
Yep.
But
and someone said the same on Twitter for independent movies, which I can see too. You know,
yeah, of course, and there's definitely benefits in those things. But the problem is that they become exclusive, and then you end up with these other opportunities that, that can't exist because of that. And in many ways, especially in an electronic form, we're increasingly borderless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this Twitter, the thing with television and Twitter that, that I think drives so much piracy to some extent is that it's, you know, it, if a show screens in the States now that I'm interested in, there's a very strong likelihood that a bunch of people in my Twitter timeline are going to talk about that show.
Oh, I agree.
And I want it now. I'd much rather watch it right now. Like, it'd be great if I could buy that show and watch it at the same time as they watch it. But if not that, then I'm going to want to watch it as soon as possible. I'm not going to want to wait 3 months for that episode where I've seen all my friends raving about how awesome it was. And I think, you know, that, not that it's as big a thing with books, but, you know, a service like that seems, you just, you got a better chance of working if you can make your customer base bigger, and the world is big.
Oh, yeah, I think so too. But, I mean, but, you know, one is that, you know, with the, you know, only because it comes up with TV all the time, and I experience the same frustration around TV, but TV's not my industry, so I'd leave it.
Well, it is mine, so I have
That's good, that's good. But I do, you know, my one thing with piracy, I do sort of feel like all the people who say, hey, the only reason, you know, and people would say this for a long time, the only reason people pirate is because, you know, the content owners aren't giving them the stuff when they want it and the price they want it. And the implication was that if they did, you know, if content owners were decent and not mercenary capitalists based in Hollywood or whatever it was, you know, then piracy would go away. And I'd love those people to step up now, you know, around things like books and say, hey, you guys pirating those books that are available right now in great electronic form published by local publishers, you guys are assholes doing that. You know, and I'd love some of the people who, you know, who maybe say, hey, there's some reasons people pirate TV, to say, hey, but in some other sectors, you guys are real gits for doing so. Yeah. That's my first thing. The second one is that I just wouldn't, you know, on the one hand, you know, no, again, TV's not my business, but I get as frustrated probably as you guys around that. And I think, and book publishers and book readers get frustrated too when you know, a book's being talked about in the New York Times and isn't available in the UK. And when I started in publishing 15 years ago, it happened all the time. And the Americans who think they, because I worked in American publishing, you know, we thought we knew everything. We were like, we don't care if it was published in the UK 6 months ago. We'll publish it, you know, 12 months from now and things, and no one will notice. And increasingly, we worked out from the market that people got madder and madder at that. And it was totally arrogant, you know. And I think now, most publishers, you know, Illuminaries was great like that, though there's an exception on it too. But, you know, realize that, hey, we want to publish this book worldwide at the same time. We want pricing to be comparable around the world. We want the publicity hit to hit around the world, and it'll all feed off each other. But that doesn't make us not like territorial rights. That Fergus Barrowman at VUP does a far better job of getting this book out to the market here than now he's forgetting the UK publisher, who's the name of the magazine too, whatever it is, than the UK publisher would do. And vice versa, Fergus would do a useless job at publishing the book in the UK, and the US publisher will do a far better job over there. And I gave that little example in my talk about some of our books where, you know, we'll get 10 times the sales, you know, and which is 10 times the readers for our books by saying, hey, there's a great popular science publisher, could we like popular science, you know, publisher in Australia who can handle it there, and the UK who can handle it there, and then foreign languages and stuff. And I think people like to diss on territorial rights, or, you know, there's other far worse names for it. It's a great engine for finding local people to reach out to readers, or if it's music, you know, a local record company getting the word out about some hot new band. It's a you know, people outside of those industries don't quite get, I think, how effective that is, and it can have downsides. It doesn't have to, you know, if you get
that definitely works.
Pricing, a worldwide time, it works fine, but you don't all the time though.
I think books and music probably don't face the same challenges that TV do, that TV specifically does. Mm. One of the things about TV though, about you know, to say that piracy is driven by a product not being available in the market isn't to justify piracy. It sort of is, I suppose, in some ways. But it's to say at the same time that that there's an opportunity that's not being taken advantage of. And there's a demand that exists, and if you don't, you know, if you don't satisfy a demand as a business, then, well, in some ways you're a fool. Unfortunately, the television industry as a whole has already got a business model that is established that is entirely incompatible with servicing that demand in a way that that it needs to be serviced. But if you look at
Dylan, you're using it as an explanation for why people pirate, which is fine.
I'm using it as an explanation.
I don't mind that, but I don't hear a lot of you or many of the others, you know, in that area of the world, come out and say, hey, you pirates out there, don't do it to these books. I'd love to hear that.
I haven't said that about books. That is true. I don't really think about piracy of books, I have to say. I feel like I buy a lot. I've got 5 more on the way from Book Depository at the moment, and I'm wondering why they haven't arrived already. But I have said that about games.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said it several times about games.
Good on you. Talk about games.
I used to download games.
Mm-hmm.
A long time ago, I used to download games. And now I have thousands of dollars worth of games here.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is Steam. And part of it is just, I don't even know what it was. The games got good enough or something, or the games started to address, you know, what I wanted. I don't even know what the change was.
Mm-hmm.
But I would never download a game now. And I've said that several times on the show.
We have the same thing with music. I mean, the iTunes store got good enough and cheap enough that it's, you know, it's like if your excuse for downloading music before was that I just want it and it's too hard for me to buy it and the CDs are too expensive and they're not available when I want them to be, those excuses are pretty much invalid now. And then if you take that even one step further to Spotify, like if you can't, you know, if you want to be a music fan and you don't listen to the radio and you can't afford to pay for a Spotify license, then you're kind of being a bit shit about it.
Yeah, but and I got to say that the music guys who hear, you know, who hear and overseas work pretty hard to make that happen. And I got to say, and recorded music here, they've worked very hard at drawing in those guys who always, you know, international companies always treat New Zealand last, you know, but actually getting Pandora and Spotify and all those guys to actually come to this country and set up in business here, which, you know, they don't have a lot of incentive to do because it's not a large market for them. And you know, I think those guys have actually worked pretty hard and pretty effectively at making our legitimate market look more like the American one, make it more possible for people not to pirate.
So several years ago, there's a chap called Donald McDonald, and he's from Wellington, and he had made numerous complaints to the Broadcasting Standards Authority, and he complained about one particular piece on One News in 2011. Where the reporter got it wrong, and the BSA decided that they were tired of Don McDonald making complaints all the time, and they fined him. Now, the thing is that he made some spurious complaints, like about the weather map looking too sexualized or thinking that he could see messages in it. And they fined him for a correct complaint that he made that was accurate. Now, I'm not telling you this for no reason, although it might sound like I've lost my mind.
It's a good story, though. I remember it.
Yeah, it's actually a terrible story, and I think that everyone at the BSA who was involved with that should be ashamed of themselves. The reason I'm telling you this story is, now, your press release did its job perfectly. You did a great job getting press. You got, you know, a lot of coverage. Pede did a great job as well. And it started quite a useful conversation. But it was also based on a fabricated story that, the best that we can tell, was concocted from whole cloth by Cameron Slater. Do you feel like there could possibly... Now, the result was good for you, but do you feel like there could have been a better seed than a file that apparently was never downloaded by anyone other than the uploader?
I'd say two things on it, Morgan. You know, one is that this was, you know, just the week before we'd had a nice New Zealand author who'd authored a textbook for Pearson was up there on Mega, and the only reason that was noticed, because it's, as people keep saying, it's bloody hard to find all that stuff up there that's pirated, was because sales of the book had deteriorated so badly at Massey University. And so the sales rep went out and had a look at what was going on, found from the lecturer himself, actually, that the student had a Facebook page that linked to a Mega file. And so we were already pretty primed and understood that Mega was full of pirated book content that was having an impact on us. So then when Cameron Slater found and appeared to show good evidence that there was a copy of Luminaries up there, we had no hesitation in putting out a press release and saying, you know, the pirates strike again, because they had. Now where we are, however many, you know, a week later or whatever like that, is we have Vikram Kumar claiming one thing and Cameron Slater claiming another. The two contradict each other, and you've decided who you think is the liar, and, you know, with their pants on fire. Neither of them have, Vikram hasn't offered any IP addresses or anything to the publisher, which he could well have done. So neither of them have offered any good evidence to me to suggest that either of them are either correct or liars. So I just leave it at that.
That's true.
To me, it's both relevant. You know, we put out a press release based on what appeared to be solid evidence, and certainly, you know, there was, Illuminaries was up there and was available for download. But you know, so it does matter in one sense. You know, the other sense is we'll never know. We've got two people who say that, you know, each one says the other one is lying.
Yeah.
And in another sense, there are hundreds and thousands of pirated books up on Mega. We chose one the previous week because it was a New Zealand title. We chose one the week later.
Yeah. Okay, so I take your point that no one's presented evidence. I would say that they have very different reputations, though. To me, Vikram has a good name to protect. Well, no, he does have a history in the New Zealand internet industry. Formerly he was the chief of Internet New Zealand. And to me, he seems really legit. Now, of course, it is subjective. I think that what would be ideal to me would be if we could find a New Zealand solution and we could take a different approach than anyone else. And part of that has to involve publishers talking to Vikram and talking to people in technology, not just suggesting that we tell people to be ashamed of themselves if they download books, although that is true, and we do need to get that message out, but just to see what ideas New Zealand technology companies have for working with publishers. Because at the moment it feels weirdly adversarial, and I don't think it needs to be adversarial with Mega, ignoring
1 minute
the Mega upload, progenitor of Mega. So I think it'd be great if everyone could actually talk, because you are reasonable, Vikram is reasonable, and, you know, when reasonable people get together, you know, in the light of mourning, when the heat has gone out of this, you know, no arguing, just discussing it and seeing, you know, what everyone can do for each other, maybe we could maybe we could do something more interesting than the Americans have come up with. I don't know. I hope so.
Maybe, Morgan. I just say we collaborate with technology companies all the time, and Amazon, despite all its limits, and Apple and Google, them diving into the book business has been one of the greatest things ever to happen to publishing. And yeah.
Five. And
that countdown four. Means that the end of three. This show is rapidly approaching. It has been two. Wonderful having you on, Sam, and I hope you enjoyed the experience, and I hope you feel like you've had a chance to have your say.
Show on sorry. With course.
All right, we're using that one.
Doesn't now, mean we're gone.
It doesn't actually mean we're gone. It's, it's more or less only symbolic, and we can keep talking.
No. But I enjoyed it very much, and I agreed with your last point too. That these sorts of tit for tat and name calling stuff doesn't help anyone very much. But it did turn out to be. You know, I said on the public address, the dialogue that was going on there, it was a good dialogue. I disagreed with what some people are saying and agree with what other people are saying, but it's good to have some dialogue around this stuff.
Yeah, and we don't all actually have to agree.
We don't. No.
But no one should feel like they're ever getting ripped off. And the only people who, as far as I can tell, are actually getting ripped off is the authors, the publishers and the authors. So, we can take with a grain of salt. And another thing, the only people calling names, me, I'm calling Cameron Slater names, and Cameron Slater, who is calling everyone names. Those are the only people who are calling names. Everyone else is being really reasonable.
I wasn't very nice to Vikram, but I'm giving up my terrible ways now.
You should definitely talk to him.
Broadly speaking, I don't think he would have made the claim if he didn't have some way to substantiate it if it comes right down to it. I don't think he needs to necessarily. I don't expect him to stump up the information, but I don't think he would make the claim without.
I think it's really important that he doesn't release that into public. I wouldn't be entirely surprised if off the record, in person, he might tell you. He told us that it is a VPN provider, which has been used to try to anonymize the access. But it was the same VPN provider that uploaded it and downloaded it. Mm-hmm. So it can't be tracked back to a New Zealand ISP IP address. Mm-hmm. But it can be used.
This is the NSA. Do you know anyone at the NSA?
That's right.
Well, they're probably listening.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't imagine so. Why would they drop that? Do you want to do a quick Urban Dictionary Word of the Week before you go?
All right, quickly.
So Urban Dictionary Word of the Week. Urban Dictionary is a website full of
User-provided definitions to phrases and words. And they're very... I mean, it's an urban dictionary because a lot of it is, lingo, street lingo and slang and so on.
So I'm going to give you your word of the week.
Urban Dictionary, word of the week.
Is book hangover.
Book hangover. Should I go first?
You may.
Book hangover. A book hangover is when you've had a book that was so good that you kept on saying, oh, just one more page, just one more chapter, and you kept on reading it until far past your bedtime, and the next morning you are absolutely stuffed. That's a book hangover.
We have a winner.
Hey, you've got to give Sam a chance.
He didn't even get a chance. Okay, I should have given Sam a chance.
It was so good. I was just going to say, he's got to have that. That's good.
There's actually two definitions. That is exactly one of them.
Exactly one of them? Was this submitted by me?
Look at that. It was submitted by Morgan. No, it was submitted by Proud Book Nerd, actually.
Hey, I've got a button for this. We've almost never used it.
We've got a winner.
Oh, yeah!
There is another definition if you want to have a crack at it.
Do you reckon this is this a whale or a hoax we're talking about here, do you think?
Ah, well, no, there's probably some other words that we can apply for that. I'm not going to find any of them.
Yeah.
The other option we have here is when you finished a book and suddenly can't return to the real world. Suddenly return to the real world, but the real world feels incomplete or surreal because you're still living in the world of the book.
Yeah.
That's quite good.
Is that your only word?
I have one more. Phone slinger.
Phone slinger. I think, Sam, you can go on this one first. Phone slinger. Right.
Phone slinger. I would struggle. Just someone who's good on the phone. Someone. We have a phone that's has a real cord at home.
Oh, a curly cord?
A phone slinger, because you can kind of you know, shoot it around like a microphone and stuff, you know, like...
That's fun. I remember doing that.
Like Gary Glitter used to do.
Yeah, spin them around, shoot them out, get them back, catch them.
That's right.
I don't think we're allowed to...
is the phone slugger, even though it's wrong.
Yeah, we probably shouldn't talk about Gary Glitter too much because...
Exactly.
So, phone slinger is difficult. This one is a hard one, Dylan. I wish that I had retired undefeated with Book Hangover. I guess phone slinger. This is a person who has one of those belt holsters, and they maybe like they're in medical sales or something, and they talk on the phone quite a lot, and they put it away, and they bring it out with a little flourish, and then they answer the phone. Hello, Jonathan from Diclofenac Fundamental Medical Supplies, and then they flourish it back into their hip.
Do you remember back in the late 90s when I had a phone hook on my belt?
I don't. You should not have reminded anyone because that is appalling, Dylan.
I remember running across Newton Road once, and it was one of the ones that you could switch it 90 degrees and then slot it in, and then it just hung there.
Yeah.
But I was running and it kind of ended up swinging and it jumped up and dropped off onto the road. But of course, in the late 90s, you could throw a phone at a wall and it would still be fine. So the phone was fine.
That's too bad. I wish you'd gotten what you deserved. I think that was a Sagem or something, one of those French
phones. No, that was an Alcatel One Touch Easy. It was beige. It was my first cell phone. It's very exciting. Anyway, the definition of the word, neither of you were right. You both failed.
You're all wrong.
Although of those two, I liked Sam's definition better because it reminded me of the cool tricks you used to be able to do with a phone that had a cord on it.
Yeah.
A phone slinger is a person who can produce their phone with lightning speed and return a text message almost instantaneously, like a gunslinger.
Right. Okay.
There you go.
That's good.
So right. beep is like draw.
Last random question.
Yep.
Yes.
What do you reckon about Twitter trends? Look at top Twitter trends in my thing today. It says number one is M23. Number two is Voteriana Grande. Don't know what either of those ones mean. Number three is Melbourne Cup. Well, I do know what that means, but what is it?
There's a website that helps figure these trends out sometimes.
I
don't even have, like, the Twitter clients I use don't even do trends, so I never even see them.
Yeah.
Occasionally I'll see it, you know, I can see a manual trend when I see tweets going by with the same hashtag over and over again, which usually does, you know, amusing. Make a film into a fart joke.
On Twitter, so we sure ain't.
No, discourse has never trended on Twitter.
It wouldn't actually be possible.
It might trend on Twitter in like if you get really localistic about it, you know, like it's currently trending in Mount Eden on the main road near the cafe.
Yeah,
that's right.
Cold, Dylan. Accurate but cold. All right, let's wrap this baby up.
Fish and chips, fish and chips.
Sorry, the show is cancelled. Beep.